Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interest.
The Media Project is a half-hour of commentary and analysis. It's an opportunity for us to talk about the issues that are confronting news media with some veteran newsroom leaders. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now with the Upstate American, and I'm happy to be with you with my colleagues here. Here is Judy Patrick, the former editor of the Gazette, now vice president of the New York Press Association. How you doing, Judy?
Hello, hello.
Hello, oh, doing just fine here. Barbara Lombardo is here, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy, and now teaching at the UAlbany.
Happy to be here.
Are you happy to be here?
I am happy to be here. She looks happy.
Miles Reed is here, editor of the Gazette. How are you?
Very good. Good to be here.
Good? You're still good? I mean, even the fact that you're the guy here in this room who is still actually having to make decisions every day, you still say you're feeling good.
I get out of the salt mines for a few hours, so I'm good. So.
Wait a minute. It's 2 weeks before election. That must be a bear of a time to be
it's
working in a newsroom.
It's an exciting time. All kinds of letters to the editor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember those days.
Mm-hmm. Letters to the editor and nasty phone calls. I was talking with Times Union columnist Chris Churchill the other day, and I was saying, you know, the difference between now I write a column in Substack, which people subscribe to, and the difference between that and having a column in the Times Union is that I get less angry mail. And I think it's because most of the people who bother to read my column agree with me already anyway. So I have basically no impact. It's something I think that we all worry about, though, if you're an opinion writer, the people who, and I would think that's true of talk radio, it's probably true a lot here, that people tend to pay attention to what they like, confirmation bias.
It's not a bad thing, but you want to reach people and maybe spark conversation and get people thinking about different points of view without wanting to threaten you.
You know, and I'm going to share your column with some of my friends because you will not get confirmation bias in that.
Oh,
I've got a lot of kind of far-right friends.
Oh, well, that's good. That's healthy.
Let's
that is
spread
unusual,
the word,
isn't it, in this world to have people who are sort of outside your mindset. You get a lot of it, Miles. You hear from all sides, I'm sure.
We do, and I think it's part of the challenge with a Substack like you do is that, you know, that's an example of that splintering of the audience, and it is often an echo chamber. It can, you know, we all sign up for those things probably that we're most interested in, like, but the general interest media, I think, has a better opportunity to sort of get multiple voices, multiple views. And I would say with our columnists and our pieces, it's about 50-50 always. You know, some people love them, and we hear about that, thankfully, but plenty of people tell us that somebody's totally biased or they're off their rocker. So, it is a mixed bag.
Are those letters and opinion pieces online for people to read? And do you allow comments on them?
So they are online. Any of our opinion pieces, guest columns, editorials, letters to the editor, everything's online, and we do allow commenting. We monitor them a lot, and we also monitor the comments on Facebook because they can be wild and totally crude, etc. We do have a paywall. You know, people get a certain number of free articles every month, and we vary. Sometimes we change it. Sometimes it's 3. Sometimes it's 10. So people who aren't subscribers can see. But for the most part, we have to have people paying. So
I see that Facebook is going to cut off new ads and not allow any new political advertising before the election. There's a cutoff date. Are you doing that with letters to the editor?
So we do have a cutoff. It's a lot closer to the election. The Sunday is the last day that we run those kind of issues-oriented letters. And our cutoff is maybe 3 or 4 days before that. I can't remember exactly day. But we try to take as many. And in fact, this week we've had a couple of days where we've had 2 opinion pages rather than 1. Just to allow a whole page of letters because they just flood in and our news hole is not what it used to be. So it's harder to get those extra pages. But we try to get as many as we can in with various voices all election season.
I just think it's so quaint of you to talk about pages. Sorry.
Well, content. But I do have a question for Miles about the letters. What, if anything, does your newspaper do about ascertaining whether a letter to the editor contains totally false statements? How do you deal with that?
So we're pretty aggressive. Our editorial page editor, Mark Mahoney, who a lot of you know, and Judy actually hired him a number of years ago. He's a Pulitzer winner. He's an excellent journalist. He's very aggressive in looking through letters and fact-checking them, looking for accuracies, inaccuracies. If it's just one of those things where it's an opinion about Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, you know, we try to give some leeway, but we're aggressive. When we see something we know is factually incorrect, we don't just reject it outright, though. We email back the writer and we say, listen, we know that this is factually incorrect.
Trump lost the election, did not win the election.
And then for example.
Give them a chance to redo
their
letter.
Yes, and we send it back to them and say, there's one fact or there's a word or something that we need you to address or we will reject it and try to allow. You know, again, we try to encourage as many different voices as we can, but we're pretty aggressive. And if it's a 50-50 thing where it might look like it's potentially racist or misinformation, Mark and I hash it out, we talk about it, we make a final decision.
I think that people don't understand how much thought goes into that, because oftentimes there's criticism from people who assume that we only publish letters to the editor of people who agree with us. Actually, readers love to read letters that disagree with the editorial position, and it shows also good faith on the part of the publication if you have controversy that differs with your point of view. So I think that's great that you're actually putting stuff out there that gives people an alternative view to what your own page might have. And I was only kidding. I mean, I think it's wonderful that people still read ink on crushed trees. It's just that it's not the default really for journalism anymore. Most of what's delivered and most of what's consumed is done digitally. And so typically, that's where most of the key decision-making comes.
Yeah, I think that we in the business for a long time just used some of that lingo without really
a
meaning
page?
Print.
Yeah.
Miles referred to pages, but also referred to the paywall. And so you're thinking content publication in whatever form.
We are. And we try to actually, we use the web as an overflow for things that we just can't get into print. So we do try to be conscious about both. And the web, while it's a big challenge to monetize it, it gives us an opportunity to run even more letters that we otherwise might not be able to run. So.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, I want to go back to something we talked about last week on this program, which was the interview with Vice President Harris done by Brett Baer of Fox News. We were pretty roundly critical of his interviewing technique, and there's been further controversy about that, as well as the CBS News interview by Tony Dokupil of Ta-Nehisi Coates. CBS News had the interview, and Dokupil, am I pronouncing that right, do you think? Tony Dokupil? I don't know. Anyway, he started off by challenging Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book, saying, see, when I read the book, I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took off the cover of the book, the content of the section on the Palestine would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist. And he sort of went after Coates by saying, this stuff is extreme. How dare you write this? Similarly, you know, Brett Baer's interview with the vice president was very much almost an attack. I think it was as though a second debate took place with Donald Trump, except that it was a much more capable debater in Brett Baer. And there is some criticism that it was not the kind of thoughtful but aggressive interviewing that we expect of journalists. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think the whole media has sort of reacted to criticisms that we in the media aren't doing enough to fact check on the fly. That when we're in these situations over the last 8 years, especially, that instead of just turning the mic and saying, okay, let this side say that one thing and then let the other side, I think there has been a challenge for all of us, but probably especially the TV, to be aggressive with fact-checking when you know that there's a potential misinformation being spread. I think in these cases, depending on what the analysis is, perhaps they've gone too far, and we do all have to really check our biases to make sure that we're totally impartial in these kind of situations. Some journalists, I think, on TV have done an excellent job. I think Jake Tapper does a great job fact-checking on the fly, but he is criticized certainly by the right as being overly biased. So in some ways, it's a no-win situation. But I think that these efforts are really a response that we have to do more in the media to challenge people.
There was a piece by Kelly McBride, who works for the Poynter Institute, which is a journalism think tank, is the easiest way to describe that. And she talked about those two interviews that you're referring to, Rex, and offered examples of not just the fact-checking aspect, but the way the questions were phrased and presented, the choice of words, the length of the questions, the multi-question nature of the questions. And she did a good job, I thought, pointing out in both of those interviews, questioning that fell short of what we would consider to be good interview techniques. And then she went a step further and proposed, well, here's a way that you could have asked the question. I'm going to use that with my class to see what they come up with and to criticize. I don't think she was correct in all of her reassignments of the questions, but listeners must feel the same way that we do, as when you're listening to something that's, they're not really asking a question, they're doing a little filibustering like I am right now, and throwing out lots of things, trying to get something that's a gotcha moment. Mm-hmm. More than getting an answer to a question.
Right. A good reporter is asking a question because they want an answer, not because they want to do a performance question. And these questions are far too long. What they're doing is taking up more than 50% of the airtime asking the question. What you really want to know, your audience wants to listen to the person being interviewed, not to the questioner. And that happens in White House press conferences. It happens way too often on these one-on-one interviews. And I think it disappoints dramatically the audience's expectations of what they're going to get out of this interview.
You know, one of the advantages that we print reporters used to have was that people didn't hear our questions. And we could ask a provocative question or stumble around in a question. One of my questioning techniques used to be, huh?
In silence.
Yeah, and somebody would then go further. I'd say, really? Or some, and you know, you can't really do that if you're on television, or if you're, even now, our newspaper reporters, as we call them, often we use the tape of their questions as well. And so that is good in terms of visibility, of making our technique accessible to the people who are consuming it. But it does take away the advantage we had of not worrying about whether we sounded thoughtful or clever, and now I guess we have to think about that. Because you don't want people to make a judgment about the journalist. It is really all about, as you said, it's about getting a good answer from the people that we're interviewing. But interviewing is quite an important skill of a journalist. And finding someone who, when you're interviewing, trying to hire someone, finding someone who you think has the capacity to actually relate to other people, to elicit information, to be tough and yet fair, is a pretty significant qualification for a reporter.
Yeah, I agree with Miles. I think that Jake Tapper does a great job. Brett Baer in his interview did not do a good job. He was just trying to demonstrate, as people have noted, to his base that he's with them, that he is going to nail her to a cross. And he didn't really care about eliciting real information from Kamala Harris.
Right. Kelly McBride, a pointer in the article that Barbara referred to, said that referred the questioning as being a perfect fodder for a class on how not to conduct tough interviews. But on the other hand, you know, we're talking about interviews that seemed biased from a right perspective. Donald Trump is, of course, now threatening the media because he says they're asking questions of him that are too tough. Or in the case of CBS News, he says CBS should lose its license, Trump wrote, because CBS aired an interview with Kamala Harris. Now, he was offered an opportunity to be interviewed on 60 Minutes, but he declined. Notwithstanding that, he's also said that ABC's license should be terminated because he was unhappy with their questioning. And, you know, I worry that Americans aren't taking that seriously, that they don't understand that the former president actually is saying that he thinks the First Amendment ought to be abrogated because it doesn't suit his political interests. And I'm sure that in saying that, that would identify me as an enemy of Donald Trump also.
Right. We're hearing that way too often about almost any Trump position, is, oh, he's really not serious, or it really will not happen, when in fact it can and it very well may happen. I mean, we've seen journalists jailed for publishing confidential information or CIA or classified information, which is totally what this country needs in order to hold our government accountable. And there's real concern that that will get worse under a second Trump administration.
I totally agree. I am worried. It should be taken seriously. And not only because he is saying it, but because he has the support of people in power who could enact laws up and down the ballots to make things terrible.
Now, it's not as though the president can revoke. Well, it's not the case that networks actually have broadcast licenses, but their affiliates do. And networks each own stations that have licenses. And while the president can't yank an FCC license, the president does appoint the head of the FCC, and the FCC could, under circumstances, try to do that. Now, we may not think that it's possible in the context of a second Trump administration, but in fact, it could be. you know?
Those stations are very, very protective of their licenses, and they know how valuable they are. I think that is something they live in fear of any jeopardization of their license. So this is a real issue for them. CBS would continue to go, but they need those local outlets, and that's what, when we talk about local news, we're talking about local TV stations and why they're so important, and they are part of the ecosystem of the media as well.
You know, for all of Trump's, let's say, bark, the fact is that the media didn't suffer during his term in office, except for his staunchest defender, Fox News, which, remember, had to pay a $787 million fine because they intentionally aired his lies and even carried them further about losing the election. And so Fox News had to pay that to settle a defamation suit stemming from his baseless claim that he lost the election. So there's some irony, or you may call it justice, in that the network that most defends and distorts its coverage intentionally to support Donald Trump is the one that paid the biggest penalty during his tenure.
And they sure learned their lesson.
We wish. They did not indeed, did they?
Yeah, just ask Brett Baer.
Yeah, I mean, we still see Fox bending over backwards to be the network of Trump. And this is why I tell people that if you're watching Fox, you're not getting an accurate picture of the world around you. Far from it. It really
is. You don't even know about Arnold Palmer.
You don't know about Arnold Palmer. Now, there you go. Thank you for bringing that up. You know, we
leave it to Barb.
You're welcome. Uh-huh. That's extraordinary to me.
He didn't cover that. Is that what you're saying? Not only extraordinary that Donald Trump raised the issue of Arnold Palmer's physical characteristics, but sorry not to be so gentle about this, but the size of his genitalia, what he was talking about, and Fox News didn't even mention it.
They knew it was a no-no. That's part of that sane washing, brainwashing. That's not just sane washing, that's brainwashing. Because they left it out so that something ridiculously awful that he said wouldn't get into the psyche of their listeners.
It's a very hard situation, I think. I mean, I'm actually grateful at this point, I think, that I'm not a newspaper editor anymore. Well, there are a number of reasons for that. But Miles, I think it's very hard when you have, on the one hand, people saying you're not doing enough to point out the danger of this man, that he's actually cognitively impaired. And on the other hand, people saying, you know, you guys in the media are all out to get him.
Yeah, I mean, it's this massive challenge about how do you treat the unprecedented candidate and how do we, on a regular basis, report on the news? And in these cases, usually running a wire story that will include that. I was surprised when I saw the way Fox did not include that. You have to believe that any assignment editor or producer would say, boy, that seems like that would be a relevant part of it. Maybe not the lead of this report on that situation, but if anybody was paying attention, you would think that they would ask for it. But it is a challenge for us to, no matter what we put in the paper in terms of coverage of the presidential election, especially having to do with Trump, we're going to get criticism no matter what happens. We just try our best to provide those stories. And, you know, we have our main wire services, the Associated Press, gets lumped in by Trump as one of these biased news agencies. All of the news agencies have been criticized at some point, especially the mainstream ones. I think Associated Press has done a pretty even job, but even they're not immune to this criticism, especially from the right.
Well, and Donald Trump even criticizes Fox News because he says they shouldn't be carrying commercials of his opponent. He says he's going to talk to Rupert Murdoch because he says the network is airing too many radical left lunatics. That would be the enemies from within, as he puts it. So
not the guy talking about Arnold Palmer in the locker room.
Yeah.
And then there's been some discussion about whether or not even discussing the comments about Arnold Palmer, was that part of his grand scheme to distract us from the fact that he's talking about January 6th being a love fest, you know, a love day, that it wasn't that big a deal? Are we being misdirected by him by these crazy outlandish statements?
Well, I don't know that there's a grand scheme of anything, but it certainly is hard to figure out. If you're covering a Trump rally, I would think for a reporter, it would be very difficult to pick out something to cover because you don't know if you should be covering the most outrageous thing he says or trying to cover the substance of what's going on there. Are you being distracted by the Arnold Palmer stuff, or should you be paying attention to what seems to be a cognitive decline, or is it not? Is it just Trump being his usual rambling self? I think it's a very difficult thing. It's always hard on a campaign trail to cover a candidate because there's so much of the stump speech that you've heard so many times before. But the distraction is such a huge factor in the Trump campaign, I think, that it is a difficult challenge for reporters.
What was disheartening to me was the reaction of the crowd, was the laughter, was mm-hmm. the acceptance. Yeah, this is another good time at the old Donald Trump rally.
You know, I agree with you, Judy, a lot in that I think a lot of what his campaign is distraction. It's this red bauble or it's some effort to do that. And, you know, this idea that you should, instead of just listening to what he says, actually look at some of his policies that he's potentially going to pursue, look at some of his potential appointees to get a better sense of it, because I think a big part of his constant sort of drumbeat is distraction, very methodical. I see people saying he is cognitively declined, and at times, you know, it seems like he's a master at controlling a crowd and understanding that he can convey this message and get people to vote for him.
Hmm. And for a guy who was shot at twice, could have been shot at twice, the things that he has said about Kamala Harris, and I think even in that same rally, he's been using hateful and coarse language that would be unbefitting a statesman, unbefitting somebody in your own family. And that comes back to the media of how do we cover that? The things that he's not saying really anything sensical in those rallies, but he is maligning her to the cheers of the crowd and coming up with these wackadoodle offbeat riffs on things like Arnold Palmer.
It's very hard to determine whether you should be covering substance or what gets voters' attention. I think I've mentioned before covering the Dukakis campaign in 1988. Does anybody remember Michael Dukakis? I was on the road for Newsday and filed a short story from Cleveland or Columbus or Cincinnati, one of those Ohio cities, about Dukakis' housing policy. That was what he was talking about that day. And my editors, this is before cell phones, and I got to the next stop and got to a payphone and called in, and they said, it's fine, but we're going to brief that, as in take down your story to make it a brief. Can you get something more on the pledge? That was the era when the issue was that Michael Dukakis had vetoed a state law that would have required the Pledge of Allegiance every day in the schools in Massachusetts. And that became such an issue, but it was over and over again. The issue of the flag became the issue that everybody wanted to talk about because that's what George H.W. Bush was pushing. And it was discouraging to me to try to write about an issue that I thought was important for our readers and to be told by my editors that instead we need to write about the flashy, fun, interesting thing that was just attention-grabbing rather than substantive.
We need both, actually, mm-hmm. to survive as an outlet. That is discouraging.
Were the editors at fault there, the editors driving that kind of coverage, or was it the establishment press?
I think that's a really fair question. Was it that the editors were trying to do what they thought was what the readers wanted and therefore, you know, trying to sustain the publication's readership? Or were they really just saying, well, we can't have somebody else writing about the flag if we're writing about housing? We don't want you to just write some boring policy story if there's something political going on at the time.
You know, I think it's a good reminder when you bring up the Dukakis campaign, Rex, that there is a tendency that I think a lot of us have, or at least the public, is that everything happening right now is unprecedented. This, you know, the campaign of Trump and this flashy, bizarre sort of sideshow. It's a good reminder, though, that for many years, when you think of Dukakis, you think of Gary Hart potentially and personality issues. George McGovern in the early 70s had his campaign derailed because of, you know, some personal family issues with his, I think it was his daughter had alcoholism. You know, so there's just this long history. And it does feel to me like we've never seen anything like this. But just to try to sort of, you know, look at it and be objective and say, we got to keep up on the real serious policy issues, as Barbara reminds us, to have balance. But the sideshow things, I think they have always existed. So
speaking of sideshows, Olivia Nuzzi, the Washington bureau chief for New York Magazine, has lost her job because of an undisclosed personal relationship with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I think we just need to say a word about this issue of personal relationships between journalists and sources, which is a no-no, obviously. I think that the problem is we think of it as only being about sex, and that is not the case. Personal relationships between journalists and sources goes way beyond that, right?
Judy actually, as my boss used to preach about friendships, about our relationships with our sources, and it's something we continue to really instill in our reporters, that you can be friendly with the people you cover and you can be civil with them, but it's really important for us to maintain that distance and not become friendly. And in many ways, the Nnuzi case is, I think, an anomaly these days, because I think the press corps today is far better than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago, when we know that a lot of the media, white men look like me, who covered white men in power, they were very close to them and they would turn a blind eye to all kinds of issues, indiscretions. And I think in general, the approach today is good, that we don't, you know, befriend these people. Again, doesn't mean we can't be friendly with them, but we ask our reporters, really, you know, you'll get invitations all the time to do certain things. Oh, come on my boat with me, come to this event. And unless you're covering, we don't want our colleagues covering, going to those things. Again, if you have to end up going to something because you want to see something, we say, we want to pay the freight. We're not taking freebies as much as possible. But the Nnuzi case, more than anything to me, it's a head scratcher. I think it's an anomaly. You know, I hope we don't make too much of it in the media that it's some kind of a trend, because I just see it as an outlier.
She thought that she would be exonerated, I think, because an examination of the work that she did didn't reflect any bias. That part is to her credit, but it was naive of her to think that it didn't matter.
Yeah.
There we go, and we are out of time here. That was Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick is here. Miles Reed, editor of the Daily Gazette, and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina, and we thank you all for joining us. Hope you come back again next week for The Media Project.
Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and editor and vice president of the Daily Gazette, Miles Reed. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.